You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko spaik tōken ua. Nau mai, haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Up Day Thursday. I'm your host Spike. I'm joined by producer Rowan and we'll be with you for the next hour. Ifai aki nei coming up on the show. I spoke with Shane Henderson for City Counselling this week on the budget officially passing, the Great North Road cycleway project and more going on at council. I also spoke to Paul Glue from University of Otago about a new clinical trial testing MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for late-stage cancer patients. And National President for the Territory Education Union, Julie Douglas, about the new funding announcement for universities from the government and the economic situation tertiary institutions are finding themselves in currently. What have you got for us today, Rowan?
I spoke with board member Taimi Allen about the recent Tihiranga Mahara paper on increasing peer support in the mental health and addiction industry. I also talked to Keith Gordon, a long-term underwater explorer, about the World War II-era shipwreck in the Hauraki Gulf that experts are warning is a potential risk to the surrounding environment.
Hey, he aha o whakaaro, I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of our pieces today, so do get in touch. Tuku patuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai lanei. Give us a call in studio on 309 3879. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
This week on City Counselling, I spoke with Shane Henderson about the governing body vote held today, the recent approval of the long-delayed Great North Road cycleway project, a new report on Auckland Emergency Management from the Auditor-General, and a new acting CEO at Council stepping in early next week. I started by asking how the governing body vote went.
Yeah, I've literally just stepped out of the governing body meeting where we've passed the annual budget for this coming financial year. And, you know, it is fairly procedural, this vote, but it's passed with almost unanimous support this time around, with obviously some caveats with, you know, I think every councillor has bits that they don't like and bits that they may be more in favour of. But that's the nature of compromise at the end of the day. So, you know, long story short, we've passed the budget and council will be continuing to get back to work.
Now that budget has passed, I guess, is that set in stone for council now? And now it's about getting down into implementing that?
Yeah, so the budget's set in stone now, so we're obviously getting down to implementing it. But the other thing on the horizon for Auckland is the long-term plan, which is our 10-year plan. Although we're going to vote on that one next year, we've actually already started the discussions. And so it might be time for our listeners to have a bit of an early think on the kind of things that they want Auckland to look like across the next 10 years. And you might even say contact your councillor or your local board and maybe share those thoughts. We'd love to hear them on the sort of things that we need to do as a city, because this is a good time to have those yarns.
Contact local councillor if you want to get your thoughts heard on the 10-year plan.
100%, man. I'd love to hear about how you think Auckland's going, whether we're going well or we could be doing a bit better. Have a yarn.
I want to move on to one of the recent developments at a council is 11 years after it was first proposed, the Great North Road cycleway project has finally been approved. Why has it taken so long to get it through and what can people expect from the project once it's finished?
Yeah, so 11 years to pass it. It's like the old mainland cheese ads, good things take time, and especially when we're talking about transport projects in Auckland. Yeah, look, well, we have the cycle network here and a very important link to sort of gradually build up a bit of a network of protected cycleways that will help people get around town much quicker and safer and with more, you know, a better climate profile, all those kind of good things. It has taken a long time because obviously these things, firstly, they need funding, so that's always battle, and we are still looking at maybe a potential shortfall, so we'll need to try and get that funded somehow. But the other thing is political will, and I guess kind of a you know, a dispute around these kind of things, and that's healthy to have these kind of debates and within Auckland residents. And these things can unfortunately mean that more consultation is needed and more discussions needed that can make projects more delayed. But at the same time, hopefully at the end of the day, we get something that most people can live with, and that's kind of the aim of all this.
This project is part of Council's long-term goal of growing and developing a more robust inner city cycle network. Great North Road will link up with K Road and the City Rail link once that's finished, along with Ponsby Road, Grey Lynn. How has work on bringing this cycle network to fruition gone over the past year?
Yeah, it has been a challenge, no doubt about it, to get cycle networks in place. But hopefully this Great North Road decision is a great leap forward for us, because at the end of the day, it's about travel choice. We want to say to Aucklanders that they do have alternative transport options other than the car that are safe, that are healthy, that can get you where you need to go and do it sort of flexibly and quickly as well. That's the sort of cycle network that we want to build. But that's also part of every other form of transport as well. So this is kind of the discussions that we're going to be continuing to have as a city over the next wee while. But I personally think that this is a good advance for us.
And I think moving on to another development this week, there was a new report from the Auditor General on Auckland emergency management, finding progress compared to their last review from 2019, but still a lot of work in a lot of key areas. How has Auckland emergency management changed post-anniversary floods?
Yeah, coming from Waitakere, I hear kind of a lot of discussion and a lot of frustration in terms of emergency management coming from the community. People needing to feel safe first and foremost, but also that progress is happening where people have lost homes, where, you know, all sorts of horrible things have happened. Look, I think we're going to be continuing to work on the policy framework behind it, which is not kind of the sexy stuff, but it's the kind of thing that we can roll out when we're responding to disaster quickly and easily. So, I think people really do expect us to step our game up on that, and we've heard them loud and clear.
And finally, there's a new acting CEO at Auckland Council taking up the job on July 3rd. Shane Wilson is replacing Jim Stabak, who resigned back in February. What are your thoughts on Wilson filling in for the role?
Yeah, look, Phil Wilson has a long pedigree of local government experience and has been directly involved in a lot of some of the major leadership stuff here on council. So I think he's a really natural choice for acting CEO. Certainly someone that I give my full support, and I've had a lot of really productive, really great discussions and a strong working relationship with. Look, honestly, man, I think it's a pretty good hire. So, yeah, very happy and very excited about the next phase, while also wishing Jim well in his new endeavours and thank him for his service.
That was City Councillor Shane Henderson.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Councilling on 95BFM.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
This week, the Aotearoa Mental Health Commission, Te Hiranga Maha, released a paper assessing just how crucial peer support is in mental health and addiction recovery. I spoke with board member Taimi Allen on the importance of this framework and the need to increase it, especially in the workforce. The paper that was released by Te Hiranga Maha highlighted the peer support approach in improving mental health and addiction services. Can you expand more on what a peer support framework looks like in the workforce?
So if you consider that, you know, one in five New Zealanders go through mental health and addiction challenges in their lifetime, we've got kind of a ready workforce of people that do recover from these things but then want to go on and help others recover from it too. So a peer support worker is someone who walks alongside someone who's still struggling with those issues and is able to bring them their whole selves and the things that they've learnt from their recovery to that relationship. So it really does, I mean, it's been proven in a lot of research both here and overseas that it has a critical role in enabling recovery and improving hope so that people, you know, recover and go on to lead really flourishing lives.
The paper also went into development of Māori lived experience. How do you see Mātauranga Māori and Tikanga incorporated in this framework?
Look, a TL Māori perspective in terms of peer support is absolutely critical, particularly for those that have told us that when they struggle with their mental health from a cultural perspective, it's often because of a disconnection of their culture, and reconnecting with their culture through tikanga and kawa and understanding the mataranga Māori and the knowledge that comes from ancestry and, you know, the stories that are passed down through generations helps them find and reconnect not only with their culture but their feeling of belonging, and then gives them kind of a bit of a support pathway to follow and experience full recovery. So it's absolutely integral, not only for us to meet the needs of Te Tiriti o Waitangi, but for people to actually feel like they're culturally safe in that recovery journey. There's some really great peer support workforce plans that are being led by Māori tangata whaiora at the moment. So we would love to see a growth of that.
And what have been the results of these current frameworks?
Look, peer support has been around for as long as there's been, you know, mental health patients in hospitals. So it's not a new concept. It's just that over the kind of the last 20 years or so, since we closed down the large institutions, that peer support has become actually a critical part of our workforce. And it's developed some both professional and non-professional pathways. So there's no, you don't have to have a professional qualification to be part of the peer support workforce, but many NGOs and workforce development centres are creating some of those professional NZQA level 4 and plus qualifications so that there's a career pathway for people entering peer support and lived experience roles.
There's also a claim that the mental health service is in need of a paradigm shift. Do you think this framework is part of the answer? And if so, why is that?
Oh, look, it's absolutely critical because, well, I mean, we have a workforce crisis right now. It's been said over and over again that we don't have enough mental health workforce to meet the needs and desires of people, and that our traditional workforce doesn't always fit with, you know, how people want to recover. A peer support workforce at this stage only makes up 3.4% of our entire workforce, which is not nearly what we need for people to be able to get the support when and where they need it in a way that's really timely and philosophically is about walking alongside someone as opposed to treating someone or telling them what to do. It's a very different workforce, and it will create an absolutely critical shift, a transformation in our mental health workforce if we could make sure that peer support is accessible to anyone everywhere, no matter who you are and where you live. You know, my own pathway through mental health services in terms of, you know, my career started as a peer support worker, and I absolutely owe my life to giving back to other people going through that journey. It's allowed me to stay well and keep well and help others through that journey. And one thing that's often forgotten with peer support workers is not only do peer support workers help other people recover, but it's been proven that the peer support workers themselves go through a critical shift in the longevity of their recovery. So it's just a fantastic workforce for so many reasons. You kind of go through a peer support service or you match with someone that has kind of a similar journey to you. I mean, some peer support places even, you get a bio of someone and you go, actually, those guys have got similar experience to me, or, you know, they love going on long walks, or they've got two dogs and two children, you know. So you actually get you get real autonomy in who you choose to work with, which is not like other sectors or in other parts of the sector.
That was Taimi Allen from Te Hiranga Mahara on increasing peer mentoring in the mental health and addiction recovery framework.
We'll be right back after the short break. Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call in 309 3879.
Slideshow Rodeo Comedy Night. Friday, June 30th at the Tuning Fork. One topic, one Microsoft presentation program, four comedians, one winner. Join some of Aotearoa's finest comedians as they battle it out for the coveted prize of Best PowerPoint Presentation. Featuring Tom Sainsbury, Hayley Sproul, Abby Howes, Courtney Dawson, and hosted by Tim Batt, Slideshow Rodeo can't be missed. Slideshow Rodeo Comedy Night, June 30th at the Tuning Fork. Tickets and info from moshtix.co.nz.
Brought to life from the page to the stage, from the beloved Enchanted Woods series. Tim Bray Theatre Company presents The Magic Faraway Tree.
Don't miss this extraordinary tale from the mind of global bestseller Enid Blyton as a captivated trio discover magical lands atop an enchanted tree.
Tim Bray Theatre Company presents The Magic Faraway Tree. On now till July 15th at the Pump House Theatre, Takapuna.
Tickets and more info from timbray.org.nz.
Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
Well, tonight there's
the Bew Bryson Collective live, followed by DJs Elay and Jack Lacier.
And tomorrow,
Warren Duncan live, followed by DJs Spliff Curtis and Katya.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
But yes, I said, if that's your KPIs, then you can KP it to yourself. Yeah. Can I grab anyone a drink? We've got beer, wine, orange juice.
Can I grab a Negroni?
Ooh, a bit beyond my liquor cabinet, sorry.
All good. Just a mojito then. Or a Mai Tai would be good.
Yeah, sorry, it's just beer, wine or orange juice.
Oh, okay. Well, just mix those three together then. We can think of a name later.
Cocktail Corner. Thanks to Lighthouse Gin, New Zealand's original craft gin. Five Thirsty every Thursday on 95 BFM Drive.
Of course, it is within this...
Hey, do you have a pen?
What?
A pen. I forgot my laptop.
Look, you're going to have to speak up. What was it?
Nothing, don't worry.
Would you be quiet?
What? Honestly, so hard to hear over all this shushing. You people ought to be ashamed.
Shut up.
Of us actually give a hoot about Commerce 335.
Tune in to Ready, Steady, Learn as a motley crew of academics from the University of Auckland take us through a range of thought-provoking topics. Every Tuesday on 95BFM Breakfast, thanks to the University of Auckland.
We don't agree with violence. We do not agree with the government. Nah, we do.
The Wire.
A new trial into MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for late-stage cancer patients has been announced this week, hoping to find a more effective way of treating the psychological impacts of a terminal illness. I spoke to Otago Professor of Psychiatry Paul Glue, one of the researchers behind the study, about the trial and the ongoing wider resurgence in clinical psychedelic research. I started by asking what overseas trials of similar treatments have found.
So there's only been one previous trial using MDMA for this patient group. This was run in California about 3 or 4 years ago. And the numbers of people he enrolled in the study were very, very small. So it definitely had an effect on anxiety. There was also an effect on depressive symptoms. But because the numbers were so small, it barely made statistical significance. Most of the studies that have been done in this patient group have been done with psilocybin. So this is the ingredients of magic mushrooms. And they've reliably shown that people's mood lifts, their personalities change. They get a lot more an element called openness. Where MDMA has been most used in terms of research has been in patients with post-traumatic stress disorder. And there must be, I guess, what, 9 studies now, and reliably about two-thirds, three-quarters of this patient group will report an improvement in their PTSD symptoms. And interestingly, just with one or two treatments plus therapy, these effects endure. If you follow people up a year or two later, they're still well. So it's a really interesting prospect.
How does MDMA work on a pharmacological level, and why is that useful for clinical purposes?
A bunch of psychedelics stimulate a type of serotonin receptor called the serotonin 2A receptor, and That seems to be a common feature for anything that will give you a trippy experience. What MDMA does as well is it releases a lot of dopamine, and that can give a speed-like experience. So it's a sort of a slightly mixed individual experience with feeling a bit wired, feeling euphoric, buzzy, plus the slightly trippy element to it.
What properties do psychoactive substances have that differ from conventional clinical approaches?
So for the first thing, if we look at, say, something like fluoxetine, you know, just a bog standard antidepressant, the first is that the onset of activity is much, much faster compared with, say, fluoxetine. Fluoxetine, if you're depressed, takes about a month, 6 weeks to work. Whereas the psychedelics being used to treat depression at the moment will often have an effect within an hour or two. Fluoxetine certainly doesn't cause euphoria or changes in perception where you might see altered colours or shapes, or that the music may have very, very different qualities to it. So that those perceptual and experiential changes are quite different besides the speed of onset. I guess if we go back to when psychedelics were first being used in medical research, which is in the 1960s and early 70s, a lot of things that we would see as being difficult to treat. So, for example, addiction disorders. There's a huge literature on using MDMA or LSD to treat addiction. So besides just plain old mood symptoms, these medications plus therapy seem to have incredibly broad applications clinically.
Had there been other clinical trials involving psychoactive substances here in Aotearoa?
We have a group of researchers up in Auckland. So Suresh Muthukumaraswamy has just completed an LSD microdosing study. Lisa Reynolds, who's a psychologist, is doing an LSD microdosing study in patients with cancer. There's some psilocybin research just starting up in Canterbury. And down here in Dunedin, we've done a lot of work with ketamine over the last decade, using it to treat different types of depression and anxiety. So I think that there is a history of psychedelic research in New Zealand, but it's still really in its infancy.
How much of a shift do you think that the use of psychoactive substances is for finding a treatment for a lot of these more resistant disorders like depression and anxiety?
Yeah, so look, probably a third of patients with depression or anxiety will not respond to conventional treatments. And they're terrible illnesses to have, and often they're enduring. So having alternatives available is really important. At the moment, we still don't have well-developed protocols for helping doctors and psychiatrists know how to use these medications. And so part of the work over the next, say, 5 to 10 years would be showing that they're safe, that they can be used by other psychiatrists, that they're effective. And perhaps one of the big wrinkles that's difficult to figure out at the moment is not just how to dose these drugs, because by themselves the medications don't seem to be as effective as when they're paired with psychotherapy. And finding people who've got training in the right sorts of therapy and who can put in a lot of hours working with people before, during and after they have their dose of psychedelic medication, I think it's going to be a much bigger challenge. It's still really in its infancy. So MAPS, who are the Interdisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies is an organization in the States who've basically for the last decade been making MDMA and running clinical trials. And their plan is to get MDMA plus therapy approved as a treatment for PTSD. Once it's available, I guess then there would be there'd need to be an initiative to train up therapists and create clinics where these could be used. So the serotonergic psychedelics, the magic mushrooms, the MDMA, the LSD, those are still very much in an experimental phase. Ketamine's different. Because ketamine's an approved drug, there have been lots of ketamine clinics that have just popped up in the States where, for say, $500 to $800, you can get an infusion of ketamine. And for many people with depression, that's been a really useful additional resource. It's with the serotonergic psychedelics, though, because you've got drugs that would otherwise be seen as illegal, it's really tough to offer those just in routine clinical practice. Again, in 5 to 10 years, all of that may change as the laws change. But at the moment, there are very few places around the globe where you could access this as part of routine clinical care.
That was Professor Paul Glue on the new MDMA-assisted psychotherapy trial for late-stage cancer patients.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
Cabinet announced an $128 million funding boost for tertiary institutions on Tuesday, following months of consecutive staff and funding cut announcements from universities, and concerns about chronic underfunding across the sector. I spoke to Tertiary Education Union National President Julie Douglas about this new funding and the situation facing universities at the moment, starting by asking her thoughts on the new announcement.
We were thrilled to see that the government has chosen to do the right thing and act. Of course, we would like to have seen maybe more money in a way that would be assuring that these job cuts could come to a halt. But the announcement also of a review into funding of the sector is very, very welcomed.
This announcement follows a number of universities announcing staffing and funding cuts over the past year. What factors have led to universities pushing ahead with these cuts, and do you feel this new funding boost would be enough to resolve these issues?
Well, look, it's been a bit of a perfect storm, hasn't it? I mean, you know, we were doing quite well pre-COVID. COVID has really, you know, had a huge impact on the university sector. The inflation, which has now resulted after our, you know, that period of time, has caused enormous problems. And what we know is that in the last 20-odd years or so, we have not seen the funding into the sector keep abreast with inflation. And so the last 18 months or so of really, you know, accelerated inflation has really laid bare that the problem that the university sector has with this chronic underfunding. So the money that they've announced in the what came out this week does not address the quantum of the deficits that both Otago and Victoria are talking about. But we really hope to see the Vice-Chancellors make some good decisions about how this money will be used to put a halt to what's happening and allow a bit of a breather to have a really good discussion with all stakeholders about what are we trying to achieve in the tertiary sector and how can we fund this appropriately.
You mentioned the review into the funding system. Also announced alongside the boost was a review into the funding system that would come in 2024-2025. Do you feel there are issues with this funding system currently?
Oh, look, we've been calling on successive governments for over a decade to address the issue of this funding model, which doesn't really reflect in any way what happens inside these institutions. So we're really thrilled. They're also talking about a review of the PBRF model, which, you know, we've always said has got some deep flaws in it and is quite inequitable, even though they keep tinkering with it. But, you know, going forward, I think we need to see a model which addresses the issue of that there are some basic baseline costs which need to be covered to run any institution. You know, whether you've got 60 students or 600 students, you need a library. You need a certain level of infrastructure which needs to be funded. And then you can look at the actual students and the cost of running each course. But at the moment, with the student achievement component, the SAC funding, it focuses merely on that bums-on-seat approach, which Grant Robertson spoke about quite eloquently the other day. And it doesn't in any way address the reality of what's happening inside the universities.
With these major kind of staff and funding cut announcements, what sort of long-term impact would this have on the university sector?
The extent of the cuts that are being proposed are deeply, deeply concerning. You know, we don't have a reserve army of labour who, you know, you can turn on and off programs when or when you don't want them and expect to be able to overnight, you know, get them up and running again. So every time we cut a course or let go dedicated, committed, you know, experienced staff, we don't just lose them this year, we lose them into the future. And, you know, we want to have a robust education system which provides for every student who wishes to enter into our institutions to pursue their passions, not some very narrow number of programs dictated to by the council of the institution. And I think that's what we have to be very concerned about, is that we're doing short our future generations of young Kiwis wanting to get an education, wanting to follow their dreams, and we have to have those in place long term. We need to find a way to deal with these short term issues that we are experiencing, there's no question, but not let the response be leaving us with a legacy of then having a diminished, depleted education system.
If this $128 million doesn't end up or fully resolving these deeper issues, what would you want to see?
Well, you know, like Minister Robertson said on Tuesday, he said he wants to see vice-councillors make very wise decisions. And, you know, there is a level of autonomy for the universities and the vice-councillors to make their decisions. But we would hope that the message is very clear, that there is a very heightened interest in the sector from the public. And I think the support that we've had in our campaign in the last month, and well, going back to last year, has demonstrated that people are aware that the universities, Te Pūkenga, Wānanga, all of our sector are the very people who train and provide for this economy the skilled workforce that we need. And so we all have an interest in this. And so I don't know what the answer is, because the vice-chancellors have that prerogative to make, you know, the decisions that they will. But they need to know that we are very keen to be part of shaping the future. And they are very clear, I think, in understanding the feelings of New Zealand about the diminishment of potential in our system. So I think they've got a fine line to walk, and I think some of them are taking this very seriously, which we are really pleased to see.
That was Tertiary Education Union National President Julie Douglas on the new funding announcement for universities. We'll be right back after the short break. You can text in any of your thoughts on our pieces today on 53995 or call in 309 3879. We'll be right back.
One, two, three, four. I count mountains. One, two, three, counter. You're a cool thing, count mountains. One, two, three.
JD. Three letters, one man, a band, oh, and now free tickets.
Sorry, I didn't get that. Can you repeat your order, please?
You heard right, B card holders. SJD is celebrating his striking new album, Sweetheart, live at the Hollywood Avondale. And we're giving away tickets to the show all this week on BFM Breakfast. 95 BFM presents SJD, Sweetheart Album Release Show, Friday, June 30 at the Hollywood Avondale. Tickets from banishedmusic.com.
Mixtape was sad. She saw shows with specific themes and thought, who am I? Then one day she realised that she'd been lovingly crafted by her father Sam for a greater purpose. To guide people into their weekend the right way. She would fulfil her mission, no matter the cost.
Start your weekend right with the Saturday Mixtape. Expect the latest drops, the deepest cuts, and everything in between. Saturday. The Saturday Mixtape with your host, Sam. Saturdays 9 to 11 a.m. right here on 95 BFM.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
A World War II-era shipwreck in the Hauraki Gulf has recently been brought back to attention as a potential environmental hazard due to the oil it contains. Although the remains have been explored, there has been no survey of the risk, and experts, along with the Hauraki Gulf Forum, are calling the government to invest in further assessment. I spoke with Keith Gordon, a long-term underwater explorer who was the first person to bring up these risks 33 years ago, about what this means now. The World War II-era shipwreck in the Hauraki Gulf has been called an environmental disaster waiting to happen because of the oil that it contains. Can you give us a little more information about the risk that this presents for both the environment and surrounding communities?
So we have been exploring the Niagara since back in 1988, and at that time we did notice the oil coming up from the wreck sporadically, and over the years following with our visits to the wreck, we've always observed oil coming up. So the question was how much oil would be still in that shipwreck. It fully loaded with oil was 4,320 tonnes, and it was on a trip from Sydney through to Auckland up to Fiji, on to Honolulu, and then to Vancouver. A regular run it did for 25 years. And how much oil it actually had on it when it left Auckland is a big question, but it would have been quite a lot. When the German mine hit the Niagara and sunk it out there in Hauraki Gulf, a lot of oil was lost at that time. But she's a big ship, and from our explorations, we've observed other oil tanks that we identified more to the stern of the ship because the mine had borrowed. A lot of oil was lost at that time in 1940, and there's records that the coastline, the beaches up in that area of to south of Whangarei, and that had oil up to 6 inches thick, and there was a lot of bird life lost, seabird and such like, that there wasn't much publicity because that was wartime. With what we can try and assess that with tanks, that estimated tanks that are still intact and knowing the amount of oil they could hold, it comes up to over 2,000 tonnes. But however, allowing for various other damage and loss of oil over years, and also oil that was used on the voyage across from Sydney on its way through Auckland. And we just really don't know, but there could be well over 1,000 tonnes still remaining in those tanks. But at this stage, it's never really been assessed, and we're working on assumptions from our observations and that.
Now, the shipwreck has been there since the 1940s. Is the risk increasing with time? And if so, why is that?
The ship is a high-risk wreck, and it's actually biologically imploded as well. You're like, the iron has been eaten away by bacteria. At the same time, you have the corrosion on the wreck and the degradation overall from various effects from the ocean, and we have earthquakes out there. Back in 1941, there was a salvage operation on the wreck to recover gold it was carrying, so explosives were used and quite a bit of damage to the wreck was done. And then back in 1953, a further salvage operation was carried out to salvage the remainder of the gold that was there, once again using explosives, and that and causing more damage to the wreck. And it's lying on its side, on its port side, and we've seen a lot of degradation over the years, major parts of sort of collapsing, and in time, it's not if, but it's when that ship will collapse. And at the time, if there is quite an amount of oil still there, which we think there could be a sudden eruption of oil, and that could be up to, let's say, 800 tonnes, 1,000 tonnes. And when you take into account the arena, the amount of oil that was lost from the arena was around 350 tonnes, and that cost about, I believe, somewhere around $28 million to clean up on that situation. we look at it that there's a survey, it needs a risk assessment survey carried out first to try and assess how much oil is still there and the structural integrity of the hull and the amount of degradation that has happened. So that's what a lot of the lately concern about is there's never been a survey carried out on the wreck to try and assess how much oil there is actually still remaining in the wreck.
Now, building on that, you brought up these risks over 30 years ago, and like you said, you, along with the Hauraki Gulf Forum, have been calling for a survey of the shipwreck for a long time. There hasn't been any action taken. Why do you think the government still has not taken action?
Well, one thing has been sort of out of sight, out of mind out there. And I've personally made approaches to various members of parliament and to government entities and that. A lot of them know the risk and that, but it's going to cost money. I mean, we've got the technology to carry out a survey. There's no problem there. But Maritime New Zealand, they're quite aware of it and quite turned. And they have put in requests for their annual budgets for money to carry out a survey, but it's been kept being turned down by the various ministers involved. So that's why the concern's been raised again now. And I understand, like the forum, are making approaches to the minister and that, and trying to impress on them the dangerous situation we may have. The oil is still leaking from that wreck, and we've seen oil slicks 15 kilometres long coming from the wreck. You always get a strong smell of oil when you're over the wreck, you know, on your boat and that. And there's no doubt there's oil there. After 83 years, this ship is still leaking oil.
That was underwater explorer Keith Gordon on the potential risks of the World War II era shipwreck in the Hauraki Gulf.
That was The Wire.
Nei da, ko ira te hotaka katoa mo tēne wiki, nei te mihi ki koutou e whokorongo ana, ikurero mai ki au mo tēne rā. That's a wrap on The Rapid Air Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today, Councillor Shane Henderson, Taimi Allen, Professor Paul Glue, Julie Douglas, and Keith Gordon. Nei te hoki te mihi ki koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You listen to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.